Jim also got it. He's very, very ecstatic over the appointment of this Mrs. DeVos as the Secretary of Education. And he almost couldn't contain himself. He was so excited about it. So I sent him an email back, and I'm going to, I have 9 questions here that I asked him. He responded to me that he could not answer these questions, which I knew he wouldn't be able to answer. But he couldn't answer them, but he considered them to be local, that whatever's in here is local. And so he gave me a little bit of her background, that she is Dutch Reformed, and he mentioned Abraham Kuyper, and it, that he, and I'm not familiar with Kuyper. Probably should be, but I'm not. And he mentioned that he is probably, the way Joe put it, he is like the number one guy in the struggle to bring Calvinism back into education, in whatever country he's in. He's in a different country. So I thought I would take just a few minutes and go through the questions with you. And I didn't expect him to be able to answer these, but my hope was he would think about them and maybe have a result beyond mere excitement about the appointment of a secretary. My first question is, I said, since she supports private and charter schools, question one, what is her definition of education? We don't know that. When they appoint people to these offices, people make judgments based upon either character, position in life, or whatever it might be. She's obviously, Donald Trump associates in a very wealthy rank of people. I mean, that's where he travels. But somehow or other, he's come up with her. And I haven't seen anything to say what is her definition of education. That's important because definition gives you an understanding of what they're trying to accomplish. Because if you define something, then you can measure your progress toward it more accurately than if you're just using words. These are just empty words. So what I do is I define education. And we've done that now for years, given this definition. And so that was my first question. My second question is, what curriculum would she recommend be taught in those schools? How much curriculum is there? I don't know, but there's a ton of it. The one thing we know is that we don't want Common Core. We want to see Common Core removed. But what curriculum would she recommend? And that means that what she should be doing, or what should, when there, I don't know if she, I think she has to be approved by Congress, Secretary of Education. But what should happen then is she should, first of all, give her definition. All right, this is what I want to accomplish in the field of education, and then recommend a curriculum which would be useful in reaching that end, accomplishing that end. My third question was, what teacher qualifications would she recommend? Would she just stay with the status quo the way it is now and say, well, the state is going to examine the school they go to and make the decision whether they can be approved and so forth? And are they going to have all this psychology and all the other stuff that they make them take? What qualifications are you going to recommend for the teachers that are going to be in these schools? I think that needs to be discussed. When ACE, they just started this a couple years ago. When they send me the paper, each year they send me a paper that I have to fill out so that when the representative comes to meet with us, we already have the information in place. He always sends it ahead. And on that form, after you go through the basic ACE stuff, did you attend workshops, did you go through, do you follow the trail of a PACE, all those things that are procedure in a learning center, they ask about the qualification of the teachers. Only they don't call them teachers, they call them supervisors. So they want to know qualification, and they then give you, after they ask qualification, they then ask the question, what's the highest level of education they've had? Well, I don't know how they interpret that at ACE. Does ACE interpret, because they've never explained this, do they interpret that if a teacher, if a person went off to college, took courses at a college, and graduated from the college with a degree, that that person is going to be better fit in the learning center than somebody who didn't do that, but has a direct call of God on their life to do it, and is therefore empowered by the Holy Spirit? If you're going to look only at what they call educational level, so you went to college and you got a this degree or that degree, and they're not going to look at divine calling and the work of the Holy Spirit in the life, they're going to come up short. Because they're going to do, and this is what's happening with ACE more and more. So they leave space in there for you. You check boxes, but there's a little space to write. So I always write a little thing in there about not knowing what qualifications they're looking for. And that would be nice if they would get, maybe in a fall workshop, teacher's workshop, have a workshop in which they discuss that. It could be a pastor's workshop, or it could be a general workshop, but where they discuss with the people there that are having schools what qualifications they expect, because a lot of these people, they come in from, they have schools where these are like, you might call Appalachian type thing. These people never went past, some of them never went past eighth grade. But they're working in the learning centers, and they're working quite well in the learning centers. They're doing a good job. So I would like them to do that, and I put that to Joe because I think that needs to be studied. I'm talking about this new Secretary of Education, Nick, and the fact that one of our brothers got so excited about her, I decided to ask some questions. My fourth question was, where Christian parents are involved, does she consider that title, Christian parent, as sufficient with regard to authority over instructional content? In other words, are we going to go back to the divine principle of the father being the head of the home, the parents instructing their child, with the father being a teacher as well as the mother being a teacher? And is that title, Christian parent, is that sufficient for that parent to then come to the school and say, I don't want my child taking that class, or I want my child studying this? We don't know that, because that's not a part of our everyday world anymore. But I would think the Christian parents are involved where they are involved, that we need to remain in that biblical position with regard to that. My fifth question was, does she allow for God's divine calling upon a child's life? How do you decide what you're going to do with this child? Here's this little five-year-old that's starting out in the kindergarten, and the school has a plan. That plan is to make sure that that child becomes a secular humanist. That is their first priority, to make sure they become a secular humanist. So when they start them at the age of five, they don't have them on you're going to be a doctor, you're going to be a fireman, you're going to whatever. There's not that, because the question is never asked of the parent, and the parent is the first person to recognize, because of the close work with their own child, gifts and talents and abilities that a child has that another child does not have. And so if you have this child, and this child is demonstrating, let's say they're very good with their hands, they're good woodworking, they can do crafts and so forth, but they have a little bit of trouble in mathematics. Well, you might begin to think in terms of, there's something about the use of their hands that's a part of that calling, and it would be, there are two kinds of arts. There's mechanical arts, and mechanical arts are you know, you're a machinist, you're a mechanic on a car. You do mechanical arts are things you do with your hands. Where, I can't think of the other one, what the other one is called. The other form of art is the painting and coloring and all that sort of thing. So where is this child at? How are they progressing to the point you have them where it's up now to that point where you're saying, well, they're going to begin what we call school. Because if they start their education, I believe they start their education in the womb. I believe the mother's conduct, songs she sings, things she says, the way she treats her own body and so forth, as a part of the education of that baby, so that when it's born, it already has a certain amount, it has a certain amount of instinct, of course, because it knows it has to eat and so forth. But I think that there's also a, if there's a godly Christian ministry of the mother to the child, whether through singing or something, there is a kind of a peace in that child. We had occasion years ago to babysit a family's children. They were good friends, and they lived just a street or so away. And I don't know why we babysat them so much. I can't remember now. But they had this one child that was very stoic. The child almost never smiled, almost never had any kind of facial expression other than a blank stare, and was in their physical actions, they were like, you know, there's no interest in doing anything or doing it well. Give them a coloring page and a crayon, and they would just take the crayon and kind of scribble. Give them something else, give them a game to play with, and they wouldn't play with it, that child. Well, we were talking to the parents one day, and the parents said that the child had been evaluated by a child psychologist and determined, now this is a very young child, and determined that the child was born in a state of depression, which I never heard of that before. The child is born in a state of depression, and I asked myself the question, first of all, is it possible that that can occur? And since then, I've kind of come to the conclusion that it can, depending upon what takes place in that period that it's being developed within the womb. And then afterwards, how is it treated afterwards? So the divine calling is not considered. The parent sees this child growing, and we fell into the trap many years ago that we let a child get to a certain age and then we send them off to Bible school. So we're going to send them to Bible school so they can become Christians in most cases, which doesn't happen. Now, obviously with Jennifer, she went to a Bible school, but she didn't go to the Bible school to necessarily make her more, because she was already a sound Christian, but she was going to become a nurse. And they had a good nursing program. So she went there and had the ability, spiritual ability, to recognize things that were being taught at the school that weren't, they didn't measure up to biblical truth. Well, she already had that establishment, you see, early on, and that was because of her parents and because of the work of the Lord in her life. So new secretary, does she know about or understand or promote divine calling? That's an important thing. I put this as important because it's essential to determining a course of study. What is the child going to study? You know, Sierra was here, Sierra had gone through 8 grades at Bristol School, and she basically hadn't learned anything. She could read a little, and she could write, but she could do almost no math, and she didn't know any grammar. She wasn't a good speller. So here she was, she'd been through 8 grades, and she came in here, and we tested her, and we had to put her down. And I told her, you're not going to be an 8th level or 9th level. You're going to be somewhere down around 3rd or 4th level to start, because we have to fit you to a curriculum. We have to give you something you can understand. And she had not at that point learned to do any of her times tables. And the reason for that was they all were required to use calculators. So using the calculator to do her math, she could simply enter the problem, get the answer, write the answer, and that was it. So here she is, she's 16 years old, almost 16 years old. And in her parents' mind and in her mind, she's a high schooler. She should be in high school. So it was a chore to have to go through this with her and tell her, you know, where you really are and try to explain that to the mother. So one of the things I did, I found out that she was really involved with horses. She not only was a very, very successful rider, she had won all kinds of trophies and ribbons riding her horse at the, not only at the fairs, but at different horse shows that these people would go to. She was a part of a team called the Boot Scootin' Buckeyes, and that was they rode synchronized horses. So their horses, I never saw them do it, so I don't know exactly what they did. But whatever the procedure was all synchronized, so that each person was going a certain place on their horse at a certain time, and she was a part of that, and they were winning these championships. They won the regional from this part of the country, and they were going to the national championship, and that's when the family moved, and she didn't get to go. But she had actually delivered a horse. She was home one day, and this horse was going to have its colt, and there was nobody there. And she called the veterinarian, and the veterinarian said, "Man, I can't be there for a certain amount of time." Well, you don't stop it. And so she went out, and all by herself, she delivered this colt. And whatever has to be done, she did it. And so she came in, and I said, "Sierra, I have an idea. How would you like to start doing something that can give you credits toward graduation that fits in with what your calling apparently is, which is to be a horse trainer?" She not only trained horses, she trained riders. So she was really, at the age of 16, she was very highly regarded in that field. And she said, what would I do? I said, "You're going to have to write. This is going to be a lot of writing. So you're going to have to write, basically you're going to write a book. And your book is going to be about from your beginning, the introduction of your life to horsemanship, how you have grown through it, the things you have done in training others, and then you're going to have to write all about the horse itself." She got excited and she started doing that. And she had written about, I'm going to say, 4 chapters, I don't know. If that's exact or not, but somewhere around 4 chapters she had written when they moved. Well, her mother was involved with horses, and when she found out what I had Sierra doing, she came over and she said, "You know what, that's really neat that you're doing that," because she's struggling so much with these other things. Well, I said, "We need to look at calling. If this is her calling," as it turned out, she only lived 2 more years, "but if this was her calling, well, then that's where we should be focusing. We still have to give her the math. We still have to give her the grammar because she's going to use it. She needs to know how to spell. She needs to have good penmanship and so forth. There's a lot of stuff, however, in the science curriculum she's not going to need. She should know history. She doesn't have to know all that social studies stuff, but she should know her history." So I made this up, and we had a plan for her when she moved away. Well, I don't know what they did in Alabama, but I know that in Alabama, she became a true, she was what we'll call looking at Christ. But when she got down there, whatever happened down there, she gave her life to the Lord, or the Lord took it, really, and she became a very devout believer. She couldn't do the horses down there like she did up here. She still wanted to, so her life was being redirected in an area of Christian service. And then, of course, the truck hit him and she was killed. So where does this woman stand on the subject of divine calling? Sixthly, I asked, does she hold to the idea of the individuality of the child, especially with regard to capacity and ability, or does she subscribe to the age grade theory? Okay, you're 5 years old, you're in kindergarten, 6-year-old, first, 7-year-old, second, 8-year-old, third, and because the psychologists have, way in time past, come up with a scheme that said, when you're this age, you should know this much. You should be able to do this and this and this. So there's a certain time when they should be able to tie their shoes. Well, now with the Velcro, a lot of these kids don't ever learn to tie shoes. But they should, certain time, be able to tie shoes. There's a certain time they should be able to color and stay in the lines. And they have this all schemed out so that when a child is going through that educational system, the system is evaluating the child based on age, not upon individual capacity and ability. How much information can the child take in? When I was in second grade, we went 2B and 2A. We had a September class and a January class and a June class. So you started in September or you started in January. So they called it 2A and 2B. And in 2A, I had Miss Danko. And Miss Danko started us on cursive. We didn't actually write cursive. We just sat there and wrote these slinkies all across the page, you know? Line after line after line of slinkies. And I don't know what else we did, but we did a bunch of that stuff. And they were actually strengthening these small muscles by having you do that in order to, when you finally got to actually writing, your small muscles were going to make it possible for you to write better. So in 2A, I had Miss Danko, and that's all she did. In 2B, I had Miss Mosley, and Miss Mosley picked it up from there. And so by the end of second grade, everybody was writing cursive. And you were they were tough on the grading. Now, they still allowed for the fact that you were an individual. And Miss Mosley, I can remember telling us, she said, I am going to teach you how to form these letters. But as you get older, you would develop your own penmanship. And people are going to be able to read things and know it was you that wrote it, because it's going to be unique to you, how your muscles are and all that sort of thing. In other words, she was talking about individuals. She wasn't saying we're all, because we're this age, we all do all this thing the same way. And all the way through school, that's the way it was. I went through 12 years of school, and in the 12 years of school, I never was in a class where I had a teacher that judged you according to age. They all judged you according to your personal character, your ability, and so forth. And then somewhere along the line, this switched over to this big psychological thing where we now take age and say, this is what you should do. And so that's where we get the concept of a child being behind. So when a child came into the school and we test, everybody gets tested when they first come in. And this particular child did not do the diagnostics, honestly. And so for whatever the reason, they did one page and skip three pages and do a page. The pages in between, in some cases, were no different than that first page, which they had done successfully. They just skipped over it. And so I didn't have an accurate idea about where this child's ability, what can they do? How much can they learn and what can they do? One of the things we're doing now is we're going to making the child read for comprehension. So when they have the pace, they have to read the pace, then we copy the questions out of the pace and give them that separately to see how much they can put over here that they just read over here. They're really having a struggle with it because they're used to having the way the pace works. You got the reading here, the questions here, and the questions are almost identical. There's a word left out. So all they have to do is to go back over here, get the word, write the word in, go back over. There's no comprehension. So I said 2 weeks ago, I told Debbie and Robin in the morning, I said, I'm changing something. Told them what I was going to do, and I said, I want these children to learn to read for comprehension because then they'll be learning. Then they'll be learning. Right now, they're not learning like they should. They're learning a little, of course, but they're not learning to the level that they probably can once they understand I have to read this better. I have to be more careful in my reading and maybe underline and highlight whatever things that seem important, so that when I'm asked the questions, I will pass the test. In this case, it's just a page of questions. But if you don't read for comprehension very well, that's an individual child. And you have to look then and say, the ability or the capacity of this child is different than the capacity of this child. Junior over here can read a page and comprehend 20%. Henry can read the same page and comprehend 60%. It's a difference in how God made their mind to receive. Now, can they improve? Sure, they can improve. But that's where you have to work with it in the study area, and where you have to sometimes make things more difficult to say, it's not going to be simple anymore. You're going to have to actually start thinking, and you're going to have to retain. And the reason, the number one reason is, they're going to read the Bible. We want them to comprehend what they're reading in the Bible. So they have to read Proverbs every morning. So they go down after opening, and they have given 5 minutes to read Proverbs. Some of them told me they have read several chapters. Some of them have not read two chapters. It's different, all right? So I said to them, first of all, you can't read Proverbs that way. You can't read Proverbs like you read a pace, because it's not written that way. You have to read Proverbs differently, because you may have two verses, one after another, that seem to go about entirely different subjects. And you have to take it and ponder it. You have to think about, what did I just read? So I said, I would rather have you read two verses and understand them than read a page and not understand anything. So all of this has to do with ability and capacity. How much can you take in? Now, how much can you put out? All right? So all of us have that. All of us have to deal with that in some fashion or other, whether it's academics or whether it's on your job, learning things on your job. When Betty started at Mary Yoder's, I doubt that you could do everything you could do now. You had to learn it. Well, now you do it, right? You just do it, okay? Why? Because her ability matched up with the capacity. Capacity could take all the information in, and now people come ask her all these questions. Elizabeth, what do I do? Elizabeth, whatever. It might be some customer up there giving them a bad time. It might be somebody on the phone. It might be something going on in the kitchen. They come and ask her. She has that kind of capacity and ability. So somebody else over there who's working might even be in a position of management or something. She finds that person's also coming and asking questions. Why? Because they don't have the same gift. They can take some in, but not the same. So when Nick was doing mechanical, Nick is one of the best diagnosticians I've ever encountered. Nick can look at an engine, listen to an engine, whatever it might be, and then give you about an hour and a half discourse on what's wrong with the car. No, you don't. I don't think so. And the result of that is there's great confidence in asking him to, I'm having this problem with my car. What do you think it is? All right? So my question is, does this woman who's going to be Secretary of Education, does she support the idea of individuality, or has she bought into this age grade theory? Well, who knows? That's not the kind of thing they bring out. I then asked what her view of Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7, where it says that the law shall be in the parent's mind, and that the parents shall teach that law to their children, and they're even going to hang it around their neck. You know, they wore the phylactery, and they wore it on their forehead, and they wore it in their hand, but they even wore the thing around the neck that had certain scriptures from Deuteronomy that they had to retain. They had to know these because they were fundamental to life, and the child had to have these down pat, because in their situation, this is the failure of the church. In the situation of the Israelites, they were looking at having mature kids at the age of 12. They were saying, look, we're going to work like anything through these first 12 years of your life, so that when you reach 12, 13, somewhere in that period, you're going to be sound in the faith. The church in the beginning did that. In the beginning of the United States and what became the United States, they did that. But somewhere along the line, something happened. None of us are privy to all of it, but something happened that was no longer the case. And they would take children, they could take them clear through, starting in the nursery, take them clear through to graduation, and then they had to say, pick out a good Bible school because we want you to go. Wait a minute, they're supposed to know that already. So in Deuteronomy, he makes this point that it is on the parent to train the child. Doesn't mean they can't use a teacher, but it's on the parent to see to it that it's done. And then in Ephesians, he said the fathers are to raise their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Nurture and admonition means oral instruction as well as physical discipline. So both of those things are to go on. So you correct what's wrong. You're correcting error. That's what you're trying to do anyway with proper discipline, with the rod. And then the instruction that goes on. Now, Bill has taken Billy and said to Billy, okay, I want you to learn to shoot a gun. And then he actually went out and shot a couple pheasants. Okay? Billy's 7 years old. All right? But he can do it. Right? Hannah, as Mabel Church would say of Hannah, she'll never be liver-growed. That was Mabel's expression for any child that was active. Always doing somersaults. And I don't know what it meant, but she would say, they'll never be liver-growed. Must have been something from the hills. I don't know. But those children are learning things. But on Wednesday night, I took some time for us to think about the actual giving of thanks. I said, I have come to the conclusion that the Thursday holiday is thankless giving, not thanksgiving. And so Billy and Hannah were the only two kids here Wednesday night. So I asked them to tell me something they're truly thankful for. Hannah said she was thankful for her family, she was thankful for her church, and she was thankful for God's word. Those were the three things. Billy was thankful for Jesus and the word and his family. All right? When Greg came up here, he took 10 minutes to talk about them being thankful for the Lord and thankful for the word. He said, that is so unusual. He's getting blown away by some of the things these kids are doing and saying. And he said, mostly what I hear is they're thankful for this toy or this video game or this whatever. But it's never thankful for Christ or thankful. And so these two little children actually ministered to him, which they have done on more than one occasion. But they've ministered, as have Candace and Nicole. And then he has to come up and talk about it. He can't to express it. So when God is commanding, since this is a divine command, if she is a professing Christian, I believe in Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. Okay, then, if you do, are you not locked into this? I mean, you can't say, I'm a believer in Jesus Christ, but I'm not going to accept the word on this thing. I'm not going to accept the scripture. The two of them you can't separate them. And God, the Holy Spirit, takes us through the word to make us more sound in the faith, right? So we learn these things. So then I asked him my eighth question, does she support the concepts expressed in the first question of the Shorter Catechism? What is the chief end of man? Chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Does she support that? If you're going to be over education, if you're going to be over education in the whole country, then are you going to say the children coming into the school are going to have to learn how to glorify God and enjoy him? Now, there is an underlying problem. And I asked that. I don't see it here. Oh, I said, if the answer to question 7 is yes, she supports the concepts of the first question of the Shorter Catechism, how will she go about enforcing it for the Christian while recognizing the impossibility of the carnal mind to achieve it? What do you got in the public schools? Carnal minds. You have carnal minds in the teachers' unions. You have carnal minds in the superintendents. You have carnal minds in the boards of education. You have you have carnal minds in the textbook publishers. You have all the way down, you have carnal people who don't recognize God. And so when you get the finished product, look at the history book you had to go through and the nonsense in there. I only looked at two or three pages, and it was things that they were blaming the reformers for. Blame the reformers for murdering, I forget how many witches, but it was a huge number of witches, which they never did. They weren't dealing with witchcraft, they were dealing with Rome. And they were contending with Roman Catholicism and bringing biblical truth against the traditions of the Roman Catholic Church. That they weren't dealing with witchcraft in that way. So I said, if she supports that, how can she go about enforcing it? All right, are you going to take if the parent is going to come to that school, let's say you have a Christian parent who's going to go up here to Bristol, and they come there in that kindergarten year and enroll their child, and they say to the people at Bristol, I insist that my child, you include in the education of my child the Shorter Catechism. I insist that you include sound biblical doctrine. And then they might give them the confession, or they might give them the five solas, or they might, whatever. This is what my child has to be taught. Now, here's the problem with the school. The school says, okay, yours is this, but all these kids are not that way. These parents are not Christian. We have to teach them all. Okay, what's the lie there? The lie is, you're teaching them all to be non-Christians. You're not making a distinction. And you're not saying, okay, so you're going to have to have, you're going to have to hire some teachers, because you're probably going to have to get some people that are sound in their biblical doctrine and capable of teaching to go in and teach this group, while this group is going to be over on the other side. And then the Christian group is going to have to be trying to evangelize over here. The same with the teachers. That's what Ron Onks is dealing with in Australia. So he's in these schools. I forget how many schools. I think he has six schools. And he's going into these six schools and teaching them creation, teaching them the law of God, teaching them the work of Christ, and so forth. He is laboring to train some of the children to become believers in Jesus Christ. And so that as they grow through their life, that's how they're going to train their children. The rest of them are completely across the aisle. They're atheistic. So they have to find teacher sponsors. So you get this teacher that comes in, but maybe is not a real believer, but wants to see the kids have the same privilege as somebody else, so they support it. And Ron goes in, and now in the last newsletter, he told how he's been informed that the state over there is actually reading his newsletters. And they're reading the newsletters to make a case against him. So he said he can't send any more out. I can't send any more out. Nothing else will go over the internet at all. There'll be no information coming, because the state is now trying to find fault with Ron Onks in what he's teaching, so they can then, I suppose, prosecute him or at least remove him, whatever the case might be. So you see, there they've got that situation. Well, how is she going to handle that? Because the carnal mind is at war with God. It cannot know the things of God. So how are you going to teach a pagan child to keep the Ten Commandments? Or what communion is about? You got a problem. So this secretary has a problem that she's going to have to deal with. And she can be the most devout Christian, but when she gets in there, the insistence of the teachers' unions and so forth is going to be, wait a minute, you have to teach all the children, but we don't want any of these taught to be Christians. We don't want them to have Christian doctrine. What that should lead to, Joe's praying that it will lead to the demise of the public schools. That's not going to happen. What could happen, though, is a mass separation where the Christians say, okay, we're going to have schools over here where we're going to teach, like, for instance, Shorter Catechism. We're going to teach biblical truth. And that's where our kids, they're not going up there, that other one. That's going to give you more trouble, because the teachers' unions are going to scream again about tax dollars. What are you going to do with the tax dollars? And Joe's last point that he made when he wrote the letter to me was, we need to remove the tax dollars from federal control and put them back in the hands of the local. Okay, that's all right. I have no problem with that. But who are the local people that are going to be handling them? And how are they going to disperse them? And how's that going to affect, you know, because you might go back to the teachers union and say, sorry, we're going to have to give you a cut in pay, we're going to have to take away benefits, and you're going to have massive strikes. So his enthusiasm is very great, but if you go through these things, I said, my last one, how will she go about enforcing it for the Christian while recognizing the impossibility of the carnal mind to achieve it? In other words, will she recognize the biblical requirement and constitutional guarantee of the right to freely exercise one's faith and protect the church from unlawful state intrusion? She will be a federal officer. She'll be in the federal government. This isn't the 1700s, when the people that were coming into the federal government were almost unanimously Bible believers. Some of them, you know, was like this, but most of them were very devout in their understanding of a creator, that he is sovereign in history, that any blessings they have, they go back to him and thank him and give him credit for it. Any troubles they have, they go back and give him credit because he's trying to do something to improve them. They had such a focus on the divine. It's not like that anymore. So for people to go into government, now I just see this morning where Hillary's taken up the chant on the recount. And so that's from the woman who said it was a horrible thing for Donald Trump to not come out and say whether he'd accept the results of the election. More hypocrisy. So when you look at this and you say, okay, these are who he's appointing, you say, if you can study and learn enough about them to say, these are good appointments with regard to restoring the United States back to a God-fearing nation to the level you can, and suppressing the secular humanists so that they become the inferior and the Christian becomes the superior. If God does that, terrific. But you can't do that without acknowledging the great conflict. So when I asked the questions, I knew he wouldn't be able to answer the questions because he hadn't studied it. But he at least said, the tax dollars, you know, and that this woman has helped homeschoolers, so she might turn out to be terrific, I don't know. But she ain't gonna do it without a fight. Look at the war in the streets of this country just because a man got elected. Look what's going on. You think the homosexuals, you think they're gonna roll over if they have somebody in the law enforcement at the top that says we're not gonna permit thus and so? We're going to have to crack down. And it's who was the king that put the sodomites out of the land immediately? Was that Josiah? Josiah removed all the sodomites from Israel. Imagine the screaming, kicking that went on when he did that. So this is not an easy thing. And we as believers need to understand that. That might intensify the prayer that goes up. And maybe we'll be a little patient with things. But by the same token, we have, as believers, we have to set down some goals for the civil government to accomplish. Amen. I quit. You didn't get to Peter.